established a relationship, which is good, but he didn't manipulate Ryan or try to turn him against me. If I could do it all again, I guess I wouldn't have married so young. I would have had kids later. I would have tried harder to keep the marriage together. But I can't do it all again, and I have two great kids. That's a lot. The Deadpan Dad. In mother custody families, the role of the father varies tremendously. Some fathers disappear altogether. Some, like Jeff, are distant and play only a minor role in their sons' lives. We can make some generalizations, however, about the relative status of mother and father. Statistics show that most mothers are worse off financially than they were before the divorce, but that fathers more often suffer depression. This is often because the mother has been the one who creates the social connections in and for the family. She has been the emotional glue, and the father feels separated and lost without the social environment he once knew. This can cause the father to become despondent or depressed and adversely affect his capacity to be with his son. He may continue to meet his financial obligations, unlike so-called deadbeat dads, but may be unable to meet his emotional obligation. He becomes a deadpan dad, as we discussed in Chapter 6. The deadpan dad is a man who is there for his son only through prescribed visits or through his monthly support payment. He is not irresponsible so much as he is confused, depressed, or emotionally numbed out about being separated from his son. Sometimes, particularly in the cases of well-to-do families, a boy will force a deadpan dad to substitute money when no love is available. Martin, 16, had idolized his father, a wealthy executive in a global corporation. But when his parents divorced, the father moved out of the suburban town where they had lived and took a luxurious penthouse apartment in the city. Martin's mother was well provided for, but his father, who was terribly upset by the divorce, soon became deeply involved in a relationship with a much younger woman, and often took her with him on his extensive business travels around the world. "I almost never saw my dad," said Martin. "He never sent me any letters. Once in a while I'd get a postcard from London or Beijing or some place. I remember on one of them my dad's girlfriend had written a little note. Hi, sweetheart. I hardly knew her." Martin's father made up for his absence in his own way. He bought Martin a car and sent him tickets to rock concerts and basketball games, always the best seats. Every weekend, Martin could be seen whizzing off to some event, an attractive girl at his side. He was, in fact, considered by many of his classmates as the ultimate in cool. He had plenty of money. He had his own car. He could do whatever he wanted. Gradually, Martin learned to speak the language of money that his deadpan father had taught him. "For my 18th birthday, I asked my father if I could have my own credit card, and he gave it to me. The first thing I did was take my girlfriend on a vacation to St. Bart. We stayed in the best suite in the best hotel. We had an incredible time. I didn't tell him about it. But when he got the credit card statement, he went ballistic. He called me up and screamed at me. I screamed back at him. I told him that he owed me. He owed me big time for leaving my mother and putting us all through such incredible shit." Although many fathers vacate their sons' lives, many do not. Sometimes it is the mother who works to keep the connection. Louise's marriage ended just a few days before her son Will was born. Her husband married the woman he was having an affair with and moved halfway across the country. "Raising Will by myself meant I had to find ways to bring men into his life. I knew I could give him a lot, but I knew there were some things only a man could give him," Louise said. She determined that, as he grew up, Will would have a positive relationship with his father. I was furious at Max for the affair and for leaving me to raise a child on my own. But I never let Will know that. I've encouraged their relationship ever since Will was an infant. I still have to call his father and say, "You know you haven't called Will in 3 weeks. Do you think maybe you can give your son a call?" For my son's sake, I have basically orchestrated this relationship over the years, so my son has a great relationship with his father and feels very close to him, although it's long distance. Louise also arranged for Will to have a big brother. Starting when Will was 7, he had Blair for 3 years. Blair's a really good guy. That was great. Then Louise built a relationship with a man named Gary, and eventually he moved in with Louise and Will. When Gary first moved in, I had to explain to him that as the adult, he needed to reach out to the child. The first few weeks were a bit tense, but since then it's worked out. There is no animosity, and now he would rather share things with Gary than with me. You know, get approval from Gary as opposed to approval from me, the mother, and I support that. Sometimes a relationship with a substitute man doesn't take. A mother may try to help her son form a bond with her new boyfriend, if the father is not in the picture, and even push a little too hard to make it work. But if that boyfriend is replaced by another, and then another, naturally the boy will feel even greater disconnection. He has already been abandoned once by a male role model. A string of disappointments in male relationships can further damage his already fragile sense of self-esteem. Some fathers, too, are less willing to stay involved with their sons' lives after the mother enters a new relationship. One who fell out of touch with his son after the mother remarried says, "Her new husband is a nice guy. He gets along really well with my son. I don't think he needs me anymore." Even when a son gets into a stable family relationship with his mom and a stepfather he likes, that does not mean he has lost his need for his father. The only message he gets from a non-communicative dad is, "I don't care about you. You're not important." But not all fathers, of course, become separated from their boys after the divorce, and some actually take sole or primary custody. The number of father custody families is on the rise, although the percentage is still very small. There is new and controversial research that shows that some boys who live with their father may fare better than those who live with their mother. Whether or not this is true, the research underscores for me just how important it is for a father not to fade out of his son's life because he assumes he is not needed or wanted. As 14-year-old Tony puts it, "You've only got one mom and you've only got one dad, so I think you really want to have both of them in your life." A society built on an outdated stereotype. Just as society expects boys to behave in certain ways, it expects families to do the same. As prevalent as divorce is, and as politically correct as our schools and community organizations have become in talking about it, society is still structured in favor of two-parent intact families. The boy without a father will find himself at a disadvantage, or at least in an awkward situation, far more often than he would like. The parent-teacher conference will always be with his mother. If he plays a team sport, his coaches will almost always be men, but not his father. At the Cub Scout sleepover, his mother may come along, but she will be in the minority. He may be invited on an outing with several friends, to a ball game or a camp out. There may be 4 sons there, but only 3 fathers. Even when teachers, parents, friends, neighbors are exquisitely sensitive to the boy's situation, the fact remains, the boy is without a father. He does not have what the other boys have. And as much as his pals may complain about curfews or disagreements with their fathers, the boy can see that these are but minor problems in otherwise strong relationships. He does not want to be different, but there is nothing he can do about it. This, of course, leads the boy to feel shame, which begins the cycle we have seen in so many other difficult situations. He puts on the mask and tries to harden himself against the painful feelings of being part of a different kind of family. Finding a safe space in a blended family. The two-parent intact family may be the model that society chooses to idealize, but more and more families do not fit the stereotype. Boys of divorce may find themselves in all manner of blended and reconstructed families that bring with them problems every bit as complicated as dealing with a stressed mother or an absent father. When either parent remarries, the boy may become part of an enlarged family that includes an adult who suddenly assumes the place of the missing parent. The step-parent may also bring along his or her children from a previous marriage. Society has developed a stereotype of the happily chaotic blended family, a Brady Bunch, in which the step-parents embrace their new foundlings with boundless love and understanding, and create a family-like group that is even more fun and interesting and loving than the two-parent family. Of course, it's seldom that easy. After 6 years of sole custody of her son and daughter, Barbara London married a man named Arthur. He had never been married and had no experience in parenting. Cameron is 10, Willa is 6. Cameron has had a hard time adjusting to having a stepfather, Barbara told me. My daughter has seemed to settle in pretty well, but Arthur and Cameron are still having a hard time. Cameron was acting out regularly. There have been calls from the school, and things at home have become crazy. At dinner one night, we had barely started eating when Cameron wanted to leave the table. Arthur told him he was not excused yet. Cameron started talking back to him, shoving his plate around. Arthur got mad at him, which made Cameron even madder himself. Finally, he swore at Arthur and called him a filthy name. Arthur went nuts. He couldn't believe a 10-year-old had called him that. Next thing I knew, Cameron was slamming the door to his room, and Arthur was ready to walk out and never return. Barbara tried to mediate between the two. She tried to explain to Arthur how Cameron must feel with this stranger suddenly trying to exert authority over him. She also tried to explain to Cameron that Arthur had never had kids and needed practice to learn how to be a step-parent. "Neither one of them had much patience with me," Barbara said. I asked her if she thought Cameron's behavior was related to his age or his gender. She thought for a while. "I think this is partly because Cameron's a boy. He tends to get angry and act out. Willa gets sad and mopey. When I think about it, I realize she's having a hard time, too, but it's much easier for Arthur and me to cope with a cute, teary-eyed 6-year-old girl than with an angry, shouting 10-year-old boy. Willa tells me about her feelings. She points to the stuffed elephant her dad gave her and says she misses her real father. When I ask Cameron what he's feeling, he says he hates Arthur." Many step-parents feel as though no matter how hard they try, whatever they do is wrong. If they try to be a pal to their stepchildren, the children reject them. If they try to become a replacement parent, the children resist their attempts to wield authority over them. If they try to ignore the stepchildren, they find it is, of course, impossible. For many boys, as we've seen, the solution is to toughen themselves up and don the mask. They hide their feelings and act as if everything is okay while they continue to suffer inside. For other boys, the solution is to act out, go wild, get in trouble. Boys in unhappily blended homes face an additional difficulty. They may no longer think of home as a safe place in which they can express themselves. When that happens, they may seek to create a safe space outside the home, at a friend's house, a gang hangout, a girlfriend's place, or some school activity. Although he may be lucky enough to make a positive connection in one of these places, it is often at the expense of connection at home. How to keep a boy of divorce from donning the mask. No one would argue that divorce in itself is a positive thing, although it may have some positive results. One parent or both may create a better, more satisfying life for themselves outside the marriage. Children may find themselves freed from a depressing home environment or from physical or verbal abuse. But divorce itself and the process of becoming divorced are anything but positive. Divorce puts sons at risk, just as it does daughters. We must learn to recognize the warning signs that a boy is headed for trouble. No two boys will react the same way to a divorce. One boy may feel intense anger toward one or both parents, another may not. One boy may become extremely depressed, even suicidal, during a divorce, another may not. Many boys will act out their emotions and become disruptive and wild. Other boys may fall silent. It's important not to make any assumptions about the boy's emotions. The only solution is to carefully observe your son's behavior and to find ways to discuss the divorce and his emotions with him. To misinterpret your son can be as damaging for your relationship as not to hear him at all. There are many behaviors, of course, that clearly indicate that a boy is having trouble with his feelings. He may have psychosomatic symptoms, become hypermature, or do poorly at school. He may have trouble making or keeping friends. He may fight or disrupt class, or engage in aggressive dialogues with a teacher. As disturbing as these behaviors are for a parent, they also offer the opportunity to begin talking. If a boy refuses to go to school, for example, that may be a time when you can start a discussion of what's really bothering him. Is it the spelling test, as he says, or is it that he misses his father? Realize that nothing stays the same. Stephen's father and mother divorced when he was 11, and his mother returned to work full-time. She was so stressed with work, financial worries, and the emotional turmoil of the divorce that Stephen decided he had to help out. He tried to assume a stoic presence and did his best to take over the running of the household. He helped with cooking, cleaning, and caring for his 6-year-old brother. He even screened his mother's telephone calls, hoping to protect her when the credit card company called about late payments. By the time Stephen reached 16, his mother had worked through her financial problems, was more comfortable at work, and was much more stable emotionally. After 5 years of allowing Stephen to play the role of the father, she unwittingly expected Stephen to return to his old role as the little boy in the house. One Friday evening, Stephen decided to go out and asked his mother if he could borrow the car. "Not until you clean up your room," she said. Stephen snapped. "I've been cleaning my own room for 5 years, and the kitchen, too. I didn't need you to tell me to take care of my brother and mow the lawn and buy the groceries, and I don't need you to tell me to clean up my room now. You can't suddenly decide to be my mother." He took the car keys and dashed out of the house. His mother cried when she thought about the truth of Stephen's statement. She had placed a great demand on him during the divorce. Now she wanted things to return to normal, but it was too late. The point is that a parent can never stop looking at and listening to the boy of divorce. His emotions at the moment of divorce will be different from those 6 months after the divorce. And like Stephen, they are likely to continue to change, sometimes quite unexpectedly, for years thereafter. Make safe spaces and special times. We have talked about the need to create safe spaces for boys where they feel unpressured, free of the gender straitjacket, and able to talk. For boys of divorce, it may be useful to formalize those safe spaces by creating regular times at which a parent will always be available and during which the child can expect complete attention. After Philip's parents got divorced, his father, Jack, was soon involved with a new woman. On weekdays, Philip lived with his mother, Ariana. On weekends, Philip stayed with his father and his new girlfriend, Joyce, and Joyce's 5-year-old daughter, Charlotte. On school days, I miss my dad. I love my mom and everything, but she doesn't like to do things with me that he likes, like play Nintendo or help me practice my batting and stuff. Then on weekends, I missed my mom. Dad wanted to be with Joyce and would tell me to go outside and play. Plus, Charlotte was always hanging around, bugging me. Philip had suffered from mild asthma for many years. After a few months of the visits to his father's new home, the asthma got worse. He began wheezing 2 or 3 times a week, badly enough that he found himself in the nurse's office at school. At first, I thought Philip's asthma had taken a terrible turn for the worse, Ariana remembers. I would be called out of an important meeting at work and rush to his school. When I got there, he would look suspiciously healthy. I understood that the nurse wanted to take every precaution and keep me informed, but I suspected something was going on besides an asthma attack. Ariana looked for help from a parent support group that she was attending, and the group leader suggested a technique called special time. As we've discussed elsewhere in this book, special time is when a parent follows the child's lead to do whatever he or she wants for a specified period, as long as the activity does not harm anyone, and with a spending cap if necessary. Ariana and Philip began doing special time for an hour twice a week. At first, Philip wanted to drag me outside to play baseball or watch him ride his bike, things I wasn't always in the mood to do after a long day at work, Ariana told me. But I did it because I had to prove that I really was willing to play on his terms. Within a few weeks, Philip invented a new activity for special time, a game in which he pretended to have an asthma attack. I was supposed to pick him up, carry him to the hospital, and then play the concerned doctor with magic medicine. Gradually, Ariana came to understand what Philip was trying to accomplish with the game, and with his asthma episodes at school. He wanted to be reassured that Ariana would always be there to help him when he needed it. Pretty soon, I started embellishing my performance. I acted terrified that he was so sick. I would tell him how much I loved him. I promised that I would always be there whenever he needed me. I even pretended I had a beeper, so he could always get in touch with me, even when he was at his father's for the weekend. Philip responded so positively to the pretend beeper, Ariana decided to get a real one. The special time and the asthma game worked. Philip's visits to the school nurse became more infrequent, and then at last ended. "I don't wheeze anymore," Philip says. "I feel a lot better now." I asked him why he thought his asthma had improved. "I guess I just didn't feel good when my dad started living with Joyce," he said. Philip and Ariana have continued to do special time at least once a week. He's moved on to other activities, Ariana reports with a smile, like making me risk my neck going rollerblading with him. During these special times, the subject of discussion is not always divorce, nor even Philip's feelings. Sometimes mother and son just spend time together doing whatever. It isn't necessary to push the boy into conversation or to make him talk. Any mother of a boy knows that too many direct and probing questions are the shortest route to turning a boy off. But the special place assures the boy that when he wants to talk, he will have a willing ear. Often that's as important to a boy as actually saying anything at all. Reassure, but don't dissemble. When a boy starts to talk about his feelings about divorce, all sorts of statements, perceptions, ideas, and concerns may come tumbling out, some of which may strike you as misguided or just plain wrong. It will not help to correct his ideas or in any way judge his feelings with comments such as, "How could you feel that way?" or "That's crazy," or "You're wrong to feel that way." The important thing is to reassure your son that you are there for him and that you love him. At the same time, it won't help to make things sound better than they are. If you know that the other parent is moving away or getting remarried, don't hide the fact. If your son wants an expensive new sound system, but it's not in the budget, don't say, "We'll see," or "That's not important." Tell him when it might be possible to buy the system, or suggest other ways he might get one, by working for it or buying a used one. Your boy needs to rebuild his trust in you, and the best way to help him do that is to be open, honest, and straight with him. At the same time, try to avoid unburdening all of your stress on him. Sharing your concerns and worries will encourage him to do the same, but revealing that you're feeling out of control may cause him to keep his worries to himself in the future. You want to be honest with him, yes, but you don't want to force him into the role as your counselor or therapist. It's an inappropriate role for him to play and is likely to make him feel awkward. It may inhibit him from expressing his own thoughts and healing his own hurts as well. The benefits of consistent co-parenting. Relations between ex-spouses may be full of anger, blame, and sadness, but much research shows that boys fare better when both parents remain involved in his life. Joint custody children tend to fare better both economically and emotionally than single custody kids, unless the relationship between mother and father is so acrimonious it provides more grief than support. It is important for a boy to feel that his parents don't hate each other and that he need not choose sides, mom or dad. So even if you would rather have nothing to do with your ex-spouse, ideally you will overcome your own reservations and help your son maintain a relationship with him or her. It will help your boy to be more honest about his feelings about the divorce if he feels he has both parents to support his feelings and that they are not trying to make him see the other parent as the villain. With all the changes that boys face after divorce, seeing one parent less or not at all, perhaps moving to a new home, facing judgment as a kid from a broken home, it is important to try to provide consistent parenting. If your son splits his time between two homes, try to make joint parenting decisions on discipline strategies and rules. Don't accept negative behavior because of the divorce. If he is suddenly acting out, try to get him to understand why he is doing it and help him see which behaviors are inappropriate. When he's handling the situation well, tell him. Let him know that you know how tough things are for him and that you respect how he's dealing with his concerns. Sometimes responsibilities around the house will change after a divorce, especially when a mother returns to work full-time or parents begin to develop active social lives. Helping around the house with younger children or with cleaning and maintenance can make a boy feel that he is contributing to the family and assisting in making a positive transition after the divorce. Asking your son's advice on where he would like to move or what the visitation schedule he thinks would work best enables him to feel less powerless in spite of so many changes. But when doing so, be careful of forcing him into the role as the little man of the house. Don't ask him to advise you on adult decisions that he isn't mature enough to understand, such as your career, or give him too much responsibility, like staying home with younger children every night. Let him make decisions he can make. You make those that require an adult's judgment. Peers can support as well as pressure. Studies show that boys from families of divorce spend more time with peers than boys from intact homes. This can be a positive or a negative factor in a boy's ability to deal with divorce, depending on who the peers are, how they view divorce, and what they do together. If a boy gets involved with other kids who genuinely like him, are willing to listen to him, and who don't judge him, his group can provide much of the connection and love that he has lost at home. The same need for peer connection and acceptance can also lead a boy to join with groups of kids who have similar feelings of anger. And research shows that, in extreme cases, it may even lure him into gangs and cults. The responsibility of the parent is to be especially vigilant in knowing who the boy's friends are, what they do together, where they do it, and to set limits on where they can go and how long they can be away from home. When the parent watches a boy closely and is positively involved in his life, the boy is less likely to skip school, become involved in gangs or criminal activities, become sexually active too early, or abuse drugs or alcohol. Families in transitions, such as divorce, are generally more at risk for parenting problems, such as inability to manage children's negative behavior. However, a study of families at risk for these parenting problems shows that parents who are significantly more involved in their son's activities and who offer more supervision than they did before the divorce were more successful in positively influencing their son's behavior. Teachers and boys of divorce. School is often the arena where boys act out their emotions about divorce, and often teachers are the ones who take the brunt of it. I believe that teachers can do a great deal to help a boy through these difficult times. Some thoughts. Teachers should be aware of changes in children of divorce, in behavior, attitude, and performance, but not expect that a child will exhibit certain problems. Teachers should be sensitive to school situations that may affect the child, such as Mother's Day art projects or family discussions, and avoid comments that will make the child feel stigmatized or ashamed. Outbursts shouldn't be taken personally by teachers, as boys often react at school outside the real problem at hand. Teachers and parents should work together to understand how the divorce may be affecting the boy's academic behavior and social situations. Teachers may need to support the child more than usual and should express a sincere interest in his well-being, whenever possible and appropriate. Teachers should be aware of custodial arrangements and the role of the non-custodial parent. Teachers should understand that there may be a lowering in the standard of living for homes without a father, which may affect a child's ability to participate in class activities, such as special field trips, or to get private tutoring if necessary. An extra note for teachers. The boy's behavior as bellwether. teachers should be especially alert to changes in a boy's social behavior or academic performance, even when the family is intact and no divorce is contemplated. If a boy misbehaves, fails, or rebels in some uncharacteristic way, the cause could possibly be a problem at home. The boy's difficulty at school may, in fact, be a precursor to more serious troubles at home, such as divorce. In this way, a boy's behavior may serve as a kind of bellwether for the behavior of the family as a whole. Surviving Divorce, a Primer for Boys. There is a beautiful Jewish folk tale which suggests that all human beings are originally conceived with both a male and a female side, that are split apart at birth as we are sent down from heaven to earth. During our youth, we search for our soulmate. Then, at the time we are ready to be married, God gathers together the original kindred souls, helps them to fall in love, and rejoins them in marriage for life. It is a beautiful story, but so painfully different from the marital realities and casualties of today's complex world. For us and our children, divorce is an everyday fact of life. Living with divorce, as I have shown, poses a unique set of painful problems, often forcing boys into yet another premature and painful separation, a third trauma. Already forced to leave the holding nest of maternal love at a very young age, and pushed over time to hide his continuing need for succor behind apathy and stoicism, a boy finds himself in a particularly fragile state if his family, his one remaining emotional anchor, is then torn asunder by parental separation. And if at that moment he is an adolescent also dealing with the second pull to be separate, a time when he probably needs adult supervision and guidance the most, his parents' divorce can cause lasting confusion about who he is, who he can trust, and who will provide him with a relationship and a love that will last. The voices we have heard of boys and teens caught in the web of divorce, and the staggering statistics reported on the dramatic impact a divorce can have on a boy's self-esteem, temperament, and academic performance, testify to the potential of trauma in this all-too-common occurrence. And yet, we must be careful not to fall prey either to moralistic blame or to callous shaming. Although some couples may enter into both marriage and divorce too lightly, many have tried their best to make a go of the marriage. Many discover, despite the most intense and genuine efforts to keep the marriage going, that they'll truly thrive best on their own. And while the trauma of divorce is especially bound to hit a boy hard, because it's unexpected, because it's painful, and because the old boy code continues to deprive him of the emotional support he needs to deal with it, I believe that all need not be seen from the vantage point of total pessimism. Boys can and do survive divorce. Indeed, to the astonishment of psychologists, some boys eventually end up doing quite well, much better than we would ever have imagined. It is of vital importance to know what makes for these differences. First, as we have seen, parents must be on the lookout for boys' sadness and distress, which often lies hidden behind the mask, constricted by the gender straitjacket. We must all be wary of the boy who tells his struggling mom and tearful dad, "Don't worry, I'm fine." Recognize that nothing is more likely to be further from the truth. Try, within bounds, to tolerate and harness his rage, remembering that anger is often a boy's first and most familiar way to express feeling. Show that you accept his need to withdraw and be silent by neither withdrawing in return nor pushing the process too quickly, but by hanging in there with patience and love. Second, assure your son that although things cannot remain the same, the divorce is between and for the parents. It is not meant to be another separation where he is concerned. Except under the most extreme circumstances, such as where one parent is abusive or mentally ill. Strive to keep the parental turmoil away from the boy and out of the ongoing co-parenting arrangement. Third, don't be afraid to lean on other adult loved ones for help. Interdependence is a normal part of our human condition. When you form new friendships and relationships with other adults, you're giving your boy this essential message. In other words, not only are you giving yourself new companionship and support, but you're opening your boy to the reality that the same is possible for him. Fourth, stress to your son that it's okay to be afraid, that mom may worry about bringing up a son without a dad, and that dad too may worry about how sad and lonely he may become if the ties to his son are weakened or cut off. Be honest and keep these discussions out in the open, within reasonable limits, and in a way that is appropriate to your son's age, so that your son gets the message that his pain is normal, that you don't expect or want him to bury his emotions or become disconnected from you, that he, after all, is not alone. As counterintuitive or overly optimistic as this may seem, it's important to attempt to teach connection throughout the divorce process, an enduring connection between a boy and his parents that no legal marital realignment will ever destroy. In your own darkest moments of confusion and despair, do your best not to fall prey to guilt and shame. Your boy is yearning for your love and affirmation. And seeing him through this complex life change with a minimum of pain is also an antidote to the feelings of loss and helplessness that you may feel. Focus on a future in which you can create a safe space for your boy to express all his pent-up emotions, positive and negative, and follow your heart's desires to remain connected to him throughout this process. In the end, no matter what the outcome of the divorce, through the power of ongoing emotional parental commitment, you and your son can share a lifetime of healthy connection and the possibility for individual and mutual renewal. Part 4. Staying Connected. Real Boys, Real Men. My boy, as gently on my breast, from infant sport thou sink'st to rest, and on my hand I feel thee put in playful dreams thy little foot. The thrilling touch sets every string of my full heart to quivering, for ah, I think, what chart can show the ways through which this foot may go? Its print will be in childhood's hours, traced in the garden round the flowers. But youth will bid it leap the rills, bathe in the dew on distant hills, roam o'er the vales and venture out when riper years would pause and doubt, nor brave the pass, nor try the brink where youth's unguarded foot may sink. But what, when manhood tints thy cheek, will be the ways this foot will seek? Is it to lightly pace the deck, helpless, to slip from off the wreck? Or wander o'er a foreign shore, returning to thy home no more, until the bosom now thy pillow is low and cold beneath the willow? Or is it for the battle-plain, beside the slayer and the slain? Will there its final step be taken? There sleep thine eye no more to waken? Is it to glory or to shame, to sully or to gild thy name? Is it to happiness or woe this little foot is made to go? But wheresoe'er its lines may fall, whether in cottage or in hall, oh, may it ever shun the ground where'er his foot was never found, who on his path of life hath shed a living light that all may tread upon his earthly steps, and none e'er dash the foot against a stone. Yet if thy way is marked by fate as guilty, dark and desolate, if thou must float by vice and crime, a wreck upon the stream of time, oh, rather than behold that day, I'd know this foot in lightsome play, would bound with guiltless infant glee upon the sod that sheltered me. H. F. Gould, The Little Foot. Epilogue. The Real Boy Code, Revising the Boy Code, and Staying Connected. For me, one of the most heartwarming experiences in listening closely to boys is hearing one of them share a thought or tell a story that reflects his resistance to the boy code, an unconscious and almost imperceptible rebellion against the gender straitjacketing that most of our sons experience every day, often arising from what seems to be his gut sense that I've just got to do what's right, or I'm just going to have to be myself. These touching moments seem to surface when the boy, despite society's rigid gender-based expectations and his own years of stoic suppression of real emotion, finally connects with a new voice within. When a boy utters these words to assert himself, when he takes on the old boy code, he is engaging in an act of heroism, a first attempt to dismantle our society's double standards and toxic views about the male gender. He may be blazing the path for a far more expansive, far less oppressive set of guidelines and expectations, a new boy code that respects what today's boys and men are really about, one that will be based upon honesty rather than fear, communication rather than repression, connection rather than disconnection. My recent conversation with Chris revealed one such boy, one such hero. Towering over me at nearly 6 feet, Chris Jackson, with his shock of red hair and intense greenish-brown eyes, seemed unusually self-confident for his 17 years. Though at first he seemed somewhat shy and reserved, as he began speaking to me, I was impressed by his candor and guileless manner. Chris, I had been told, was a top athlete at his school, an able pupil, and one of his school's most respected student leaders. Our conversation covered a range of issues, but Chris seemed most interested in talking about his friends and about the ups and downs of his relationships with them. "I've got a good group of friends," he boasted with a proud smile. "I've never had any major problems with them." "No conflicts whatsoever?" I asked. "Well," he confessed, "now that you mention it, there was that whole scene with Dan that started out as just a hassle but really upset me." Chris explained to me that Dan Norton had been his friend since kindergarten, that they had lived in the same working-class suburb of Chicago for as long as he could remember. The two had been t-ball teammates and soccer team co-captains, and now they were varsity co-captains of the high school football team. "We were pretty close for a long time," Chris volunteered. "We went through a lot together. Dan's parents got divorced, and my mother had breast cancer recently, although she's doing fine now." "It sounds like a pretty important friendship," I offered. "Well, we used to spend a lot of our free time together," Chris continued. "And yes, we were good friends, actually very close friends." Chris seemed relaxed when talking about his feelings and comfortable about sharing with me how much he had cared for Dan. But apparently things had recently changed between the two childhood buddies. "I guess I should say that we were good friends. I used to really like the guy until he started to have this one big problem that just completely annoyed me." "And what was that?" I asked Chris. "Well," he answered, "Dan would always be late and keep me waiting, like when we were supposed to meet up in the morning to take the bus to school. It took me a while to say anything to him. You know, I sort of needed time to sort things out in my own mind. So, did you confront him? I asked. Yep. And when I did, he was really mean, really negative in response. He said some awful things like, "Who do you think you are?" and that kind of thing. But I didn't want to react right then, so I walked away and tried to think about it, to let it blow over. But Chris found that the more he puzzled about this incident, the more upset he became. Somehow, I couldn't let go of it in my head, and then it dawned on me why. It wasn't just the stuff he was doing to me. You see, he was also starting to pull pranks and hassle the younger kids at our school. Like, ever since he made varsity, he'd rank on the freshmen, hide stuff from their lockers, and sometimes he'd just rough them up. He didn't do anything real bad, but I could see he was, like, terrorizing these younger kids. So what did you do about it? That's when I told him he was becoming a jerk, that he was going too far. These kids didn't deserve to be ranked on or beat up. You know, I asked how he would feel if one of the seniors started giving him a hard time. And how did Dan respond to that? Well, he was like, "Come on, Chris. What's gotten into you? Have you become a little wimp or something? Don't you remember what those seniors used to do to us when we came up from junior high? It's just part of being a guy." Chris, in fact, did remember all the hazing, even some of the roughhousing that, though never physically harmful, always left him with a deep sense of shame. He even remembered one kid who teased him when his mother had to go through a mastectomy. "It sounds like going to your high school can be pretty rough," I suggested. "Yeah, back then, my older brother, who was a junior at the time, was like, 'Chris, just act tough and ignore them, and they'll lay off you.'" "Did his advice work well for you?" "Well, yes and no. I mean, yes, it kept the other guys from hassling me, but you know, it's stupid to have to act tough all the time. You get all wound up inside, like maybe you're going to have a heart attack or something. You feel awful about yourself, like you're just a big dopey loser. And now that I'm on the other side and I see what these little kids have to go through, I don't really think it's worth it. So when I see Dan roughing up the little guys, I'm like, 'No way.' I told Dan, 'Why don't you just cut the shit? All it does is screw kids up, like it did us. It's just not right.'" "So what did Dan say to that?" I asked. "Well, Dan and I were still friendly for a while, even though the way he treated the other kids, almost like a bully, bothered me a lot. But then, Allison moved to town."
"Allison?"
"Yeah, she was this really neat girl, kind of funky, artistic, and real smart. You know, in English class, when the teacher would ask all those tough questions, she always had the right answer. I liked her right away."
"She was a friend of yours?"
"Well, she wasn't like a girlfriend or anything. I mean, she was just a friend, more like a sister. We started to spend some time together. Unfortunately, this wasn't the cool thing to do."
"Why not?"
"First of all, she was new, and kids weren't sure they liked her. But she was different. Her clothes, the music she listened to, and that stutter she had. You see, when Allie was a little girl, she was real shy and would stutter when she talked in front of the class. She told me that she used to be like, 'That's right.' Her parents got her help for this, speech therapy, I think it was, and it mostly went away. But even these days, if she gets real nervous, sometimes it comes back. And when we started at high school with the older kids and everything, she had some bad days with a lot of stuttering."
"So Dan wasn't too supportive of Allison?" I asked.
"For some reason," Chris explained, "he seemed to really hate her, and I knew he ranked on her behind her back. But then one day in math, when she was trying to answer a question, the stutter came out, and it was real hard for her to stop. The juror... Finally, the teacher realized it and just tried to change the subject.
but from the back of the class I could hear this big old horse laugh. I knew that laugh. It was Dan's. I wanted to do something right then and there, but I knew Allie wanted to fight her own battles, and so I respected that. I kept quiet. I didn't want to make her feel even worse than she probably already did. "Good for you," I offered. "But after class," Chris continued, "it got worse. After the teacher had left, Dan and a couple of other guys surrounded Allie and were saying, 'Grr, grr, what's the matter, Allie? Cat got your tongue?'"
"Was everyone involved in the teasing?"
"Some of the other kids were giggling, but most just seemed pretty angry, and so they took off. Funny thing, all the girls and other guys mostly left, and it was only Dan and a couple of other boys who hung around and teased her. Allie started to defend herself, but the stutter wouldn't stop. She started crying and ran from the room, with Dan laughing the whole time. It was pretty awful."
"What did you do about it?"
"I just couldn't stand it anymore. I walked right up to Dan and said, 'Dan, cut this crap out. I've told you before to stop the bullying. Can't you see you're hurting Allie?'"
"How did Dan respond to that?"
"He stepped real close to me, you know, his face right into mine, and said real loudly, 'What you going to do about it, you wuss?' It was a direct challenge. He was shouting at me. I knew he was looking for a fight. I don't really know what I would have done, and maybe never will, because just when he was trying to pick a stupid fight with me, these other kids came up to us and were like, 'What the hell?' A bunch of guys from the football team were there, and they were just shouting, 'Hey, back the hell off, Dan!' My friend Kevin was shouting, 'Chill out, Dan,' and pulled him away. Then Greg said something like, 'Hey, Chris is right. Why are you bullying her? She's a nice kid, so lay off.' And then four of the guys went up to Dan and said, 'You lay off Chris, and you leave Allie alone. And if you lay a hand on either of them, we know just where to find you.'"
"How did you feel about that?" I asked Chris.
"I was really happy that they sided with me. Me and Allie were sort of the underdogs, and the other guys were taking our side. Like, maybe my older brother would have told me to just stick with Dan and act cool and tough. But here were four of the other guys from our team defending me and Allie, sticking up for her rights. And my parents told me I handled it well, too."
"So how did it turn out?"
"Well, Dan never bothered Allie again, and I think he got a little less rough with the other kids, too. I'd known him for a long time, though, so after a while I tried to talk to him, to explain my feelings, and he just went, 'Well, Chris, I guess we're in different worlds now.' You know, I felt bad for a couple of days, but then I kept thinking, 'Okay, why did I finally stand up to the guy?' And the thought that kept coming to mind was, it just isn't right. Somebody's got to try to change these things."
"What things do you mean exactly?"
"Like that guys have to act mean and rank on other people, or that kids like Allie who have problems get teased. It just seems like a big waste. I think everybody's human, so everyone should be treated the same. This year when I was going for class president, my campaign message was, 'At Hickman High, there's a place for everyone.' I thought some people might think I was a nerd or whatever, but I decided that I just don't mind anymore. It's a good thing, because now I'm class president, and Dan seems to be coming around, too. I think I know why he felt pressured to act like such a jerk, and so maybe now we can just let the past be the past, and someday even be friends again." As this story reflects, it's quite possible for a boy today to break out of the gender straitjacket, buck the old boy code, and still win the approval and love of family, friends, and society at large. Despite the pressure on him to behave otherwise, Chris stood up for himself and for his friend Allie, and triumphed in the end. Unbeknownst to Chris, he was acting like something of a pioneer, rebelling against our old rules about masculinity, and thus breaking new ground for boys and for men. About 40 years ago, society began the process of discarding its old rules about girls and women that tied them down to traditional feminine and maternal obligations, required them to forfeit higher education and then depend financially on men, and barred them from participating in the many professions, activities, and pursuits once thought to be either unladylike or for men only. While we've hardly finished the process, we've come a long way in opening a broad range of opportunities to girls and women, and in helping them feel comfortable sounding their true voices and being their true selves without fear of being seen as anything less than 100% feminine. We've come a long way in liberating girls and women from the gender straitjacket that for years they've been forced to wear. Boys like Chris show us that society seems to be ready to begin an equivalent process of liberation for boys and men. We are starting to revise the old boy code that for ages has cut our boys and men in two, calling upon them to suppress their loving, sensitive, emotionally expressive sides, and then bemoaning the lack of these qualities in them as adults, especially in their relationships with women. Boys like Chris are beginning to question the double standard of masculinity that has pushed boys and men to feel they must choose between being the kind of tough, competitive, unfeeling, uncommunicative man traditionally celebrated as masculine, and being the kind of open, expressive, egalitarian man now heralded as ideal by much of contemporary society. Boys like Chris show us that, yes, boys can have some or all of these qualities without having to choose between them arbitrarily, that there is a way for boys to be at once tough and gentle, vulnerable and courageous, dependent and independent. Like Chris, they can handle some tough situations on their own, but decide to lean on their peers without being shamed. Like him, they can play a rugged sport like football, and yet steer clear of unnecessary physical fighting. Perhaps, at last, we're beginning to cherish all the emotions and qualities that boys naturally have inside themselves. Love, fear, empathy, guilt, anger, sadness, bravado, loyalty, courage. All of these are normal, healthy parts of the real boy. It seems we're getting ready for a second gender revolution. The boys we've met in this book all seem to be telling us, some directly and some more subtly, I want out of the old boy code. I'm sick of hiding important parts of who I really am. And I want to be able to be myself. Today it would be virtually unheard of to require a girl to stick to old rules about being a good little girl, refrain from showing qualities historically celebrated as masculine, such as assertiveness or independence, or to restrict herself to expressing only half of the person she genuinely is. I believe that boys like Chris are finally catching on that, in a very similar way, it's simply no longer acceptable for boys to have to follow the old boy code rules. Stuff away feelings and behaviors once labeled feminine, and suppress half of themselves to avoid being shamed. I hear boys telling us, enough already, and let's move on. Boys seem eager to unite their private and public selves, to feel proud of who they really are, to be freed of the shackles of shame that have held them back for centuries. Chris teaches us that boys do care, they do love, they do nourish, they can be tough, they do flex their muscles, and they greatly value their friendships. Boys like Chris are helping us to codify a new set of rules for boys and men, a code for the real boy. Here at last will be a set of rules, much like those we've been striving to enforce for girls and women, that say, every door is open to you. There's not just one right way of doing things, and you are good just the way you are. I believe the time has come for us to allow boys to craft this new, far more flexible code of manhood. As we've seen, boys are not biologically wired to act in just one boy-like way. They are not mean-spirited, violent, or toxic. There is not one single way of acting or being that is more masculine than the next. Boys are simply not the stoic, self-confident loners of Procrustean myths. As tough, cool, independent as they may sometimes seem, boys yearn desperately for friendships and relationships. Despite the bragging and bravado, boys like Chris, just like most girls and women, may feel devastated when these friendships or relationships suffer or fail. They, too, can become sad, frightened, and lonely, suffer low self-esteem, and tumble toward serious depression. And, as we've seen, boys may actually become traumatized if emotionally they're pushed away from their closest loved ones before they're truly ready. In spite of all of society's messages to the contrary, parents cannot love their boys too much or somehow spoil them with too much caring or affection. In fact, boys with parents who remain emotionally connected to them do better in school, are more healthy psychologically, and when they become adults, achieve greater success in their careers and relationships. Unless they are conditioned not to be, boys are eminently loving and caring human beings. Like Chris, today's real boy sincerely wants to help others. He's sensitive to what other people feel, and he does not want to hurt them. He takes action not only because he knows that it's right or just, but because he feels genuine empathy. But as we've seen, if this empathy is to stay alive, a boy must feel that others will reciprocate. If we withhold our love and affection, our boy feels ashamed and then hardens himself. If we don't stay active in his emotional life and listen to his feelings well, he comes to believe that his emotions are not welcomed. In sum, if we don't give him our empathy, he won't give empathy to us. Real boys need people to be with who allow them to show all of their emotions, including their most intense feelings of sadness, disappointment, and fear. Real boys need to hear that these feelings are normal, good, and masculine. They need to know that there really isn't any feeling, activity, or behavior that is forbidden to them as boys, other than those that could end up seriously hurting them or somebody else. They need to be taught connection rather than disconnection. They need to be treated with the same kind of caring and affection we hope they'll be able to express when they become men in the next century. They need to be convinced, above all, that both their strengths and their vulnerabilities are good, that all sides of them will be celebrated, that we'll love them through and through for being just the boys they really are.
The End. You've been listening to Real Boys, Rescuing Our Sons from the Myths of Boyhood by William Pollack, Ph.D., narrated by John McDonough. This book is copyrighted by William Pollack, Ph.D. This recording is copyrighted 1999 by Recorded Books. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Free Range Kids, Giving Our Children the Freedom We Had Without Going Nuts with Worry, by Lenore Skenazy, narrated by Susan Bennett. When Lenore Skenazy wrote a newspaper column about letting her 9-year-old ride the subway alone in New York City, little did she realize that the response would spark a national movement. Her outspoken, common-sense approach to parenting galvanized a huge wave of supporters, and a counterstorm of protest from others who dubbed her America's worst mom. In Free Range Kids, Skenazy asks, how come we had so much more freedom when we were kids? and gives practical advice on how to give that same freedom to our kids today. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. Call us toll-free or log on to recordedbooks.com to learn about our latest releases and special offers, order another recorded book, or to enjoy author interviews and narrator profiles. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail, and thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.